welcome into this edition of the Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lav. Well, folks, before we get into the awesome ending, the Zurich Classic, before we get into Nelly Korda earning major number three, we first have to discuss the news, Rex, that almost made us fire up the emergency pod machine last Friday. That, of course, was the breaking news that Jim Furyk is your new U.S. Ryder Cup captain, is going to be leading the squad in 2027 at Adair Manor. What was not your instant reaction, but your reaction that you've now had a couple days to simmer on?
I looked at a headline on Golf Digest. Our colleague Shane Ryan wrote a column about the Ryder Cup. He writes a lot about the Ryder Cup. But the headline was, I got to the rest of the story, but the headline was, Jim Furyk's the Ryder Cup captain the U.S. needs. And I think that pretty much explains it. If you go back, I'm pretty sure we did this after Paris when he was captain last time around, and you break down a lot of his decisions, a lot of them were questionable. I'll start with his captain's picks on that particular golf course. Doesn't seem like he made some good choices. Didn't seem like he made good choices with some of his pairings. All of that being said, I guess I keep coming back to the idea that why do Ryder Cup captains, either U.S. or European, only get one turn? I think you and I both have compared this to Team USA basketball seems to have it right. They have a coach that's the coach for a decade or longer. You have the continuity. You have all that institutional knowledge that goes into it. Why not give Jim Furyk two or even three tries? Why not give a Davis Love two or three tries? Because my guess is Jim Furyk learned a lot in Paris that he's going to apply next year in Ireland. He learned a lot about what not to do in Paris that I hope he applies next year in Ireland. So, yes, I tend to agree with our colleague Shane Ryan that he's the captain we probably needed, because there wasn't another option out there. There was a short list, and unlike last time around, the PGA of America didn't get caught flat-footed this time by Tiger Woods when Tiger Woods essentially withdrew his name from consideration to be captain next year. They had another list they could go to. They had a plan B, and clearly Jim Furyk was at the top of plan B, and I will say it's probably the best option given everything else that's going on out there.
Probably the best option. That is a
not a wholehearted...
That's a ringing endorsement if I've ever heard one, except I kind of agree with you, Rex. Like, I think two things can be true at once. I think that this choice by the PGA of America selection committee was really uninspiring and safe. And yet I also think it's fine given the circumstances. The Americans are very likely in a year and a half's time to be a huge underdog in Ireland. I really think it's selfless of Jim Furyk to take on a role again where he's very likely again to be tagged as a 0-2 Ryder Cup captain. You mentioned the fact of why not give a couple of these captains second go rounds. Davis Love III was one of those guys who had a second go round. The difference is those were home matches. Yeah. 2012 blew it on the final day at Medina when they had a 10-6 lead heading to the final day. Completely redeemed himself 4 years later at Hazeltine. Jim Furyk suffers a 7-point loss in France in 2018. Now he has an opportunity to redeem himself and for the U.S. team to win on the road for the first time since 1993. You mentioned sort of a dearth of options for the Americans. I'm not sure I necessarily agree.
I think there was plenty of options. I just don't know that any of them were better than Furyk, because that was the question I was about to turn on you. Give me an option that was better than Jim Furyk.
Look, they were all going to be inexperienced option. They were all going to be question marks. They weren't going to be quite the wild card that Keegan Bradley was. And if you do read that Shane Ryan column that's posted on golfdigest.com, and I encourage everyone to do so, he made the case that that was such an off-the-wall choice for Keegan Bradley that it set the Americans back significantly. And Jim Furyk is the choice that can sort of bring back the system that they developed ever since the collapse at Medina, and just trying to get things in order, trying to at least mimic or emulate what the Europeans do so well. And so, yeah, I could have seen Justin Leonard get a spin. I do think that Webb Simpson could eventually be the American equivalent to what Europe has with Luke Donald. And Luke Donald, of course, is going to be going for three Ryder Cups in a row in 2027. He's sharp. He's shrewd. He's motivational. I think Matt Kuchar could probably get a spin as well. But again, those are simply one-off captains who are just trying to make their mark. Jim Furyk at least has experience in this arena. He knows what it takes. You go back to the President's Cup in 2024. Keep in mind, he was the captain for that squad as well. He was heralded and hailed for everything that he did that week. The inclusive culture, taking Keegan Bradley under his wing to show him what it was going to be like. You look at what happened in the Ryder Cup, even though that did not go the Americans' way. At Bethpage Black, he was a great sounding board for the players there. So I do think Jim Furyk has an opportunity, Rex, to avenge what was a really big blemish on his playing and competitive career with what happened in Paris.
And I think you and I both should do full disclosure here. He's now a colleague of ours at the Golf Channel. So to be fair, everything that we say, we acknowledge
live
the
from,
idea that
stand up
live from. That's right. I actually offended him during the live from during the Masters about taking a seat for me. So I've got that going for me. I'm not afraid of my colleague Jim Furyk. No, of course I'm afraid of him because he yelled at me once and he made me feel bad about it. However, I will say to your point, the professionalism that he's going to bring to the job, I think is very, very important. I don't think you can overlook this. We can sit and pick apart. And again, we did pick apart everything we feel like he did wrong in Paris. But I don't think anybody is going to look at him and say, no, he's not prepared, or no, he's not professional, or no, he's not going to find a way to get that team to play as one. And I'm with you. I think a guy like Jim Furyk, a guy like Davis Love, I would be really curious, because if I turn the question back on myself, who would be better? I was leaning towards Steve Schuchar. If we're going to if we're going to circle back around and try to find a second time captain that we think could be successful in Ireland. And that is a big if. That's a big could. That could is carrying a lot of weight on that one. It would be Steve Schuchar. My guess is, I don't know this, but Steve Schuchar probably didn't want the job. Like it really took a toll on him last time. I think everyone who was around him.
I'm not sure anyone, Rex. Who would actually be standing up with their hand raised?
Who would want an away and away? I mean, in my mind, the fair way to do it is you would probably give the incoming captain a home game and then let him take it overseas and see if he could do something there. Decades with an S, multiple decades, back to 1993, long streak of not having won over on European soil for the United States team. It is such a tall order. And again, I feel like he's probably the best choice. May not be the captain we wanted, but he's the captain we probably need right now. I still can't imagine in any universe where he's able to get it done at Adair Manor. As you pointed out, Luke Donald has proven he's brilliant. He knows how to push all the right buttons. He knows how to get that team to play as one. We've seen the team is really good. It'll change a little bit, but it'll largely be the same core of players. And it's a home game on their course with their crowd. It's going to be a tall order.
Yeah, look, I think in a perfect world, the Americans would have done what the Europeans did in 2023 to 2025. Luke Donald, he was the fill-in for Henrik Stenson. No one really knew what to expect with Luke Donald. All of a sudden, boy, this guy has every I, every T crossed and dotted. Like, it was just amazing. Let's absolutely run it back. Let's see if we can do something that we had not done, again, in historic fashion since Madonna in 2012. It was really a revelation. I think they were hoping that Keegan Bradley was going to be that spark as well at Bethpage Black. Instead, it backfired spectacularly. Historic deficit heading into Sunday, even after the rally in the final day singles. And so I think you would have loved to have that carryover effect. I still think Webb Simpson had that potential to do a double dip. I'm not sure Jim Furyk would again get the nod in 3 years' time when the Ryder Cup head back stateside. But who knows? Who knows? He's clearly well-liked by the core of this American players. And again, the reviews from his captaincy at the President's Cup in 2024 were very, very positive. It was interesting, Rex, after he was named captain, I did a deep dive on the 2018 Ryder Cup. And boy, I had forgotten some of the intricacies of that week. It was spectacular. You had reports of Brooks Koepka and Dustin Johnson potentially coming to blows. Remember Patrick Reed venting to the New York Times? Not just
on the plane ride home. On the plane ride home. He's on the plane with the other players and he's venting. About Jordan Spieth, no less. Yeah.
About Jordan Spieth, who broke up the partnership. Keep in mind, Jordan Spieth partnered with Justin Thomas that week and they went 3-1 together. But Patrick Reed was still mad that they broke up the partnership. He was venting to the New York Times about the fact that Furyk benched him twice during those matches, which, given his match play record at that point, was a little bit of a surprise. Newsflash, Rex, Patrick Reed is very likely to be on this American team, not just the President's Cup team, which I think is certainly a possibility this year at Medina, captain, of course, by Brant Snedeker, but also in a year and a half's time by Jim Furyk. Boy, wouldn't that be fun? But also, Rex, in 2018, there was a lot of talk about the lack of preparation, the American players not taking a scouting trip. And there was also talk about the captain's picks. And that's, you mentioned sort of the past failures of this American team and what happened in 2018. Here's where I think Jim Furyk can really learn about what happened. You talk about the preparation, and the Golf National was obviously a very different setup than what most Americans were looking at. A very claustrophobic layout. They pinched in the fairways. They grew out the rough. Only Justin Thomas on that 12-man roster played in the French Open at the end of June to get a look at the golf course. And obviously when they came, it did not go well. The captain's picks of Furyk's that year in 2018 went 2-10. But the players that he selected, like, we've got the benefit of hindsight now. At the time, they appeared to be no-brainers. Like Tiger Woods, who again was supposed to be a vice captain in 2018. He was coming off the back surgery in 2017. He has this incredible year. He was just coming off the win at the Tour Championship. Phil Mickelson at that point had just made his 12th consecutive U.S. Ryder Cup team, had won earlier that year in Mexico and had a couple of top 15 finishes heading into the Ryder Cup. Bryson DeChambeau, that was before like the beefy big Bryson era where he was bombing it everywhere. This was where he was very much A to B, a plotting type who had won two playoff events heading into the Ryder Cup.
I don't think he was ever
well.
A fairway finder.
And the fourth one, he absolutely was a plotter type. That's exactly the way that he won in 2015. Absolutely. His ball striking, his iron play were the strength of his game. He was an average length hitter back in the 2015 to 2018 year. That is why he went through the transformation that he did in 2019 heading into 2020. And Tony Finau, again, rounding out those four captain's picks. Maybe you could have picked Xander Schauffele at that point. But Tony Finau was one of four Americans that week to post a winning record in Paris. And so, yes, the numbers are ugly. They're gaudy. They're 2-10 for his captain's picks. At the time, I don't think anyone was grumbling at them.
No, they were. I mean, I talked to plenty of stats guys who pointed, they knew what they were going to do with that golf course. I mean, you can say that Jim Furyk and the U.S. team got surprised by that golf course, but everyone else knew what to expect. Maybe even Justin Thomas, having gone over there and played the French Open. And what you did is you brought players in with those captain's picks that weren't known for hitting fairways. Certainly Tiger Woods, coming off the win of the Tour Championship, as you pointed out, was playing well, but Tiger Woods has never been known as a fairway finder. Certainly Phil Mickelson has never been known as a fairway finder. So yeah, it's easy in retrospect, but I would even argue in real time, there were people who were kind of rolling their eyes at those picks and what he was doing.
There was no way at the time they were going to take Zach Johnson and Steve Stricker types and leave Tiger.
Well, they were vice captains. They would have been better off with Zach Johnson and Steve Stricker and Jim Furyk.
That was the irony, of course.
He'd have been better having the guys who had golf carts play that week because they at least could have found those fairways because that's how difficult it's going to be. And to be fair, Adair Manor's not going to be anything like that. I mean, having been there, they say it's Ireland's Augusta National. And when I showed up, I was like, yep, this is their Augusta National. Like, this is an unbelievable golf course. It will not be Le Golf National take two. That's not what this is going to be. So he's going to come into this with a different mindset, and he's also going to have a vastly different team. So I am looking forward to that. And again, I go back to the idea, it's not a bad idea to get a captain that has experience. Maybe that experience wasn't great. Maybe it was a negative experience, but you can only learn from a situation like that. And I think when you talk about, you and I know Jim Furyk a little bit, we've had a chance to spend some time with him. And I will tell you, he's not going to leave any stone unturned. Yeah. He's going to make sure that whatever team he takes over to Ireland is going to be prepared.
It might not be creative. It might not be imaginative. No. It might not be outside the box, but that didn't go very well. Rex, if you'll recall, and at least the Americans now have a plan. We're sitting here in late April, about a year and a half to get ready. Jim Furyk appears to be devoting his time to other things, broadcasting, now the U.S. Ryder Cup captaincy as well. I'm very curious, as is everyone else, to see how he does in Adair Manor in 2027. But at least the Americans have a plan at this stage. All right, let's get into the Zurich Classic, which of course concluded on Sunday. And Rex, I'm trying hard not to let the last hour of this golf tournament skew what I really think about the Zurich, because four ball stinks. TPC Louisiana stinks. I don't think this format works anymore in this new competitive environment where Brian Rolup is trying to make every single tournament count. And he's trying to create the most competitive and cutthroat environment and atmosphere on the PGA Tour. All that said, man, was this an incredible ending with the best case scenario, Matt Fitzpatrick hitting a remarkable long-range spinning bunker shot to kick in range to gift his younger brother, Alex, not just a PGA Tour card, but a two-year exemption through 2028. This was pretty cool, wasn't it?
It was cool. And to see the look on Matt's face when he hit that bunker shot. And I think I could get this wrong, so I apologize. I believe it was Trevor who made the comment as soon as it came off the club face that he caught too much ball. And I think everybody, the insinuation being that maybe he caught it a little bit thin, could not have been more perfect. And the look on Matt's face when he stepped out of the bunker, he didn't even look over at Alex.
Oh, like so much swagger.
So much swagger. It was grade A, 100% stuff. I absolutely loved it. It's funny. You should have been here in Casa Hoggard watching it, because I can tell you, Trevor, my middle son, had some attitude about it as well. His take was, and I'm not quite sure why this was his take, but it was set up too easy. And I go, you want to see teams in four ball struggling on a harder golf course? That you think that's going to be entertaining? Because I can tell you, it's not.
Too easy. I mean, TPC Louisiana is easy. This 31 under total was a tournament record. They only shot 71 on the final day. It was lift clean in plays after thunderstorms blew through on the weekend. But alternate shot, you and I have played alternate shot in in the Red Solo Cup, Golf Channel's former head-to-head competition, RIP. I don't like four balls at all. Like, I don't think that's interesting whatsoever. But alternate shot, 72 holes of alternate shot, especially on a golf course, which, again, if it was playing a little bit firmer and faster and potentially more balls running off into the hazard, I think could be absolutely disastrous. But there's certainly an element of intrigue and suspense that exists in that format, which is not apparent in four balls, which is why I absolutely loathe it.
And I don't even mind four balls, because again, I like watching the
boring,
world's best.
It's slow. They make birdies. Well, who cares?
It is slow. Of course, and I will say,
you're the best players in the world.
Sunday's play was just terribly slow. And I'm not blaming the Fitzpatricks or anyone else. They were playing in foursomes because of the team format. I understand it's a little bit different. I will tell you, and we've had this conversation with our buddy Steve Sands about how the PGA Tour staff is so good about getting the times right. Like, it's not by accident that almost every tour event finishes on Sunday at 6 p.m. And they have figured this out. There is a science to that. And I think they went almost 20 minutes long on this with no playoff, no huge. And the last group was at least a hole behind. I think I heard Colt Knost say at one time. So you're right. It's painfully slow. I think to your point, and this kind of came up a couple of times over the last few days, I've been asked, well, what would be the future of a Zurich Classic as a team event in the future PGA Tour schedule? And point blank, it's not going to be a tier one event. I can guarantee you that, because you cannot have the competitive integrity of those tier one events, which will be, I mean, those things will be gold. If you can get into those things, the points, the money that you're able to earn is going to set you up for a career, as opposed to, I love the Alex Fitzpatrick story. I think it's worth pointing out, he's currently seventh on the Race to Dubai in Europe. Yeah. So he was probably on his way to earn, he had a good chance of earning his tour card, PGA Tour card on his own this year, but that was an awesome story. You're right. The absolute best case scenario, I guess, to go to the competition, and I'm kind of with you. I was not entertained most of the week by this, and maybe it was because of the Fitzpatrick's brilliance. Like, they seemed to just be walking away from the field the first three rounds. The last round, though, and the last hour or two was entertaining to me, because in a weird world, and they touched on this during the telecast, it looked as if Matt was feeling it more than Alex.
Yeah, which is weird. Like, I had no idea who was actually feeling the most pressure. Was it Matt Fitzpatrick, the number three ranked player in the world, the hottest player in golf right now, who has an opportunity to carry his younger brother across the finish line? Or was it Alex Fitzpatrick, who's trying to realize all of these dreams? To again, even if he was going to earn his PGA Tour card, Rex, through the Race to Dubai, and again, he was number seven in those standings, this was even more important because there's now job security. It wasn't just earning a PGA Tour card for 2027. It's a PGA Tour card with a two-year exemption through 2028. That allows him to set his schedule, establish a base, get ready for the rhythm and the cadence and just the lifestyle of being a PGA Tour member. That was huge. You don't see sort of the retention rate very high among not just Korn Ferry Tour graduates, but also on the DP World Tour as well, because the adjustment is so large. And so, I mean, it's a life-changing, it's a career-changing stakes. And I thought it was really cool that Alex was the one who stepped up to the plate. Matt Fitzpatrick's game sort of deserted him on the back nine. Yeah. Alex hit an amazing flop shot from behind 13 green after Fitz airmailed the green, hit a great tee shot on 17, which set up a really good birdie look, even if his brother couldn't convert it. And obviously we saw Matt Fitzpatrick kick in as well, hold a nice putt on 15, hit a phenomenal bunker shot on 18 to create a moment that, as he said, was as good as it gets.
Well, and as you pointed out, it's a two-year exemption, but this year he's got a PGA Tour Plus card. So he will play in all of the remaining signature events the rest of the year. He'll get into next year's Players Championship. He will get into the PGA Championship. So you could not have set your brother up for success better than that. And I actually saw some stuff on X, which is kind of weird, talking about, well, the PGA Tour likes to lean into meritocracy. And I get where this conversation is coming from. As I just pointed out, Alex is seventh on the Race to Dubai on the DP World Tour. I think he has one finish outside the top 25 this season on the DP World Tour. He just got that first win in India a few weeks ago, and I think he's just missed one cut this year. So he was trending in the right direction. He clearly has tons and tons of game. And I think you're right. I think Alex found some sort of calm in the situation. Clearly having your brother, the world number three next to you, is going to bring it. But it was Matt in a world bizarro world where he started feeling it, because I'm sure he knew exactly all of those things that you just pointed out, all of these things that my brother is going to be able to experience alongside me. I mean, they talked about this during the telecast. They don't get to spend a lot of time. The European Tour and the PGA Tour don't cross over very often over the course of a year. So it's a really cool story.
I mean, and it begins this week at the Cadillac Championship, which Alex Fitzpatrick would have not been eligible for. He would have been on a flight to Turkey on Sunday night to play in a DP World Tour event. Instead, all of his schedule has changed. Just a really cool story. I am curious, though, Rex, how do you think this story is going to sit in the locker room? Now, this is not the first time that we've seen a player who entered the Zurich Classic on a sponsor exemption in this team event trying to get that lottery ticket. Remember, a couple years ago, Brooks Koepka, before he joined LIV, had his brother Chase Koepka along the ride. They made a run a couple years ago to try and get him a PGA Tour card as well. Do you think that this is necessarily going to sit well with the membership, or do you think that this is even more ammunition for Brian Rolapp and the members of the Future Competition Committee to look at the Zurich Classic and blow it up, saying, look, we're trying to make the most competitive cutthroat tour in the world, and all of a sudden we have a guy in a team event hitting half the shots who is now exempt on the PGA Tour for the next two and a half years.
No world ranking points. I think that answers the question. There aren't any world ranking points handed out at this event. Billy Horschel, our friend of the program, brought this up a few years ago after he had won, that had he actually gotten world ranking points, he would have been much higher at the time. It led to a long conversation. Blow it up, I guess, would be the answer to that. And not because it's the Fitzpatricks. Right? I mean, you can't lean into Alex's a deserving player. I truly believe he was going to earn his tour card. Anyway, this just made it a much better story, and we'll follow this story the rest of the season. Blow it up for the reasons I pointed out. It can't be a tier one event, 100%. Like, that's the starting point. And I don't even think
it'd be a tier two event. It's current iteration.
I don't think so either. And because you cannot have a situation where every week is so meaningful, that every week is essentially do or die, that you have to get it done this week or you won't be able to move on to the next step. And now all of a sudden, as you pointed out, you've got someone hitting twice as many shots. And it was at Bay Hill earlier this year, and I just happened to stumble into a conversation between one player and an agent who was saying, I do not want to play with player Y. And he's like, well, why? And he's like, because he's not playing good, and I have to have a good week that week. Like, I need something to spark me this season. So you get the mentality that I can point to plenty of players that have decided over the course of the years that, oh no, I want to be paired with that guy. Like, I'm paired with that guy, I like my chances.
I mean, that was the Shane Lowry, Brooks Koepka mode, sure, wasn't it? Brooks Koepka's trying to get the signature events for the remainder of 2026, and Shane Lowry said, you're the best available player and I want to win the golf tournament.
Absolutely. And I think there's something to be said for that. But in this new reality, as you pointed out, where it's, you get to keep what you catch. Like, you only get to keep what you kill. In this particular case, you have to do it with your own hands.
And look, it pains me to say it, because I'm an ideas guy. I like things that are different. I like changing things up, but I don't think you can have a two-man team competition in the new and improved PGA Tour. Like, I don't think it works at the beginning of the season when guys are trying to get reps and it's really important to start your year off well. I don't think it works at this time of the season with everyone, you know, starting to jockey for position. It certainly doesn't work later with status and, you know, just owing to every single week being important. Do you just throw it at the end of the year as a sort of a silly season event? I don't know that it necessarily works there either. It pains me because, look, I want to see the match play back on the PGA Tour schedule as well, but that has a different sort of vibe to it. That was a old WGC event. No one's mistaking the two-man team competition at the Zurich Classic for anything resembling those types of tournaments. And so that's why I think, unfortunately, it should be left in the cutting room floor for the new and improved PGA Tour.
And I'm saying this format should be on the cutting room floor, not this tournament.
You can have a 72 hole stroke play tournament. I hope it's not a TPC Louisiana, but I do think it can go back.
Change that. Zurich is a wonderful sponsor. New Orleans is one of the top markets that you hear Brian Rolapp and his team talk about all the time. The PGA Tour wants to go to more often. Move it to City Park. I know LIV Golf played there, is going to play there. I know that's a bit problematic right now, but it's in the center of the city. And I know a little bit about New Orleans, and it would be such an event. It would turn into a party, something not quite Scottsdale-like, but something close to it. And you can make it a very special event without having all of these other things trying to turn it into something special. Look, the two-man team event, I think this was the ninth year. It turned this event into something it wouldn't have been otherwise. I think it served a purpose over the course of a decade. Right now, going into this new decade where it's all about meritocracy, it's not going to survive. I don't believe that.
Couldn't agree more. I've covered it a bunch. Used to love it mostly because I was in New Orleans on a company corporate card. But I do think it's run its course with a two-man team competition. I still think there's room for a tournament in New Orleans, just not in its current iteration. All right, that's a wrap on the PGA Tour news of the week. But Nelly Korda is winner at the Chevron Championship. We'll also do an edition of Love It or Lav It coming up after this short break. All right, Rex, how about Nelly Korda, who blew away the field by 5 shots at the Chevron Championship, the first major championship on the LPGA season, played for the first time at Memorial Park in Houston. To me, this was so impressive because Nelly made a statement early on, and she never let up, led by at least 2 shots for the entirety of the golf tournament. What was your biggest takeaway?
There's wire-to-wire victories, and there's wire-to-wire victories. And I would say Nelly's was one of those on the other side, on the plus side of this. I mean, it was just a dominant performance from start to finish. And it kind of goes to what she's done all season long. She wins the opener in Orlando, and I know it's a little weird because the final round got canceled because of weather conditions. But the only thing she hasn't done since then is finished third. Anything worse than second place is essentially what she's done this year. And I love two things I loved about watching this event. One, the Houston Open was played on the same golf course just about a month ago. And I always really, I'm interested in the idea of how a golf course is going to play for the men and women in such a close window. We had this at Pinehurst in the U.S. Open and U.S. Women's Open a few years ago. And it actually looked like it was a much more sterner test for the women. It looked like the rough was a little bit thicker. It looked like the golf course was a little bit firmer. But it was Nelly's performance that just blew you away. And it's not that she was dominant from start to finish, is that there was cracks in the armor along the way. On Saturday, clearly her putting just wasn't there. Ball striking was normally sublime as it always was. But to hear the interview she did afterwards on Sunday about the idea that it was a hard weekend, but she wanted to kind of show that you don't have to be perfect. And I immediately went to the idea that Rory's done that in back-to-back Masters now. Like, I think the idea that you have to be perfect, not just to win on the LPGA Tour, or the PGA Tour, or even a major championship, you don't. All you have to do is make sure you give yourself an opportunity, then execute when you need to. And I thought that was the coolest part about the weekend.
I mean, it is interesting, her point about you can still miss putts and you can still miss short putts and win major championships. Those short misses were probably the reason why, Rex, she has not gone undefeated this season. She has lost to a total, Nelly Korda has, of 2 players this season. She has lost to 2 players in 2026, certainly harking back to what we saw back in 2024. Remember when she won 7 golf tournaments, everyone thinking she's going to continue that run in 2025, goes 0-for that season on the LPGA when the parity was really reigning. It does show you, Rex, with how good her statistics were in 2025, the variance that we see at the top level. And Scottie Scheffler has talked about that as well. Why did you win 3 times one season and 7 times in another? Yes, certainly situationally, it can play out well. You make a birdie where otherwise you might not have, or a player slips up in a position when it looks like he's going to win the golf tournament and you sort of backdoor in it. The variance happens week to week on the LPGA, but great play is consistent and carries over. Nelly Korda is operating right now at a level we have never seen her play in before. It's very exciting. It's certainly exciting for the LPGA with all of the new brand awareness that they have, the new recognizability, really pumping the stars that they do have to a wider, more mainstream audience. They don't have any bigger stars than Nelly Korda. And for her to deliver in the first major championship of the season and to play the way that she has in 2026 is very, very exciting.
And I'm glad you brought up 2025, because I think you and I probably had this conversation on Golf Today in January during one of those freezing cold weeks that we were up in Connecticut. The idea that what was wrong with Nelly back in 2025 and what can the expectations be in 2026? And as you and I both kind of did the same experiment where you start breaking down, like, show me something that was wrong statistically in 2025. And she was better ball striking wise in 2025. Her putting was about the same as it had been in 2024 when she had won, when she had been a dominant player. There was no good reason. And I know that's not the way the game is played. I know when the lights come on and the camera is turned on, we have to have a good reason. But there is no good reason for that other than golf can be weird sometimes. You're right. Scotty is good about pointing this out. I think there was probably more parity last year on the LPGA Tour, just across the spectrum. The idea that there was more players in the mix on a weekly basis. And I just think maybe golf got in the way. It only takes a bad bounce here or there. One bad bounce a week to... That's probably the difference between her finishing tied for six last year and her winning, because you look at what she's done this season, and I will compare, it's a small window, it's a small sample size so far, but you compare what she's done statistically this season to last year, it's virtually just a carbon copy.
It most certainly is. And I think she's been hardened in a good way by what has happened over the past 2.5 years. She experienced success at a level we hadn't seen in decades on the LPGA back in 2024. Then she went through the winless season in 2025, sort of understanding why that was happening, not getting too frustrated. Seems to have a better mindset in 2026. And again, as major season is now kicking off, that is very, very promising. I will say, Rex, she has one of the most aesthetically pleasing swings in golf, just like technically brilliant. Peep the cannonball technique that Nelly Korda had jumping into Poppy's Pond to the right on 18.
Is it Poppy's
Absolutely
Pond?
Absolutely textbook.
Is that what it's we should call that?
There, look, it's going to be going away.
I don't know.
In 2027, there's a redo spurred by Tom Doak to actually redesign 18. There's going to be a water feature all the way down the right-hand side. I'm not sure you're going to want to jump in that anyway. I think this little handmade pool is probably not for the duration, but the technique, oh, chef's kiss, my seven-year-old would absolutely love it. All right, it's time now, speaking of love it, for love it or nice. Lave it. And if you're new here, the rules of this game are very, very simple. You can either love something or you can lave it. You can hate on it and bicker all you want. Let's start with a report from Flushing It Golf on social media, who Bryson DeChambeau spoke to and said that he is going to, quote, figure out a way to stay with Liv. Went on to mention that he's still working with the league on a potential contract for 2027 and beyond, says that he has a responsibility to the league and its players to sort of find some sort of agreement. Are you loving or laving Bryson's long-term future with LIV Golf?
I'm laving that. I understand where he's coming from. There are young players that are on his team that are on the other teams. He has equity in his team. I think he truly believed in the model that is LIV Golf. And I'm not even saying, I'm not going down the road of saying that LIV Golf is over. I think you and I addressed this pretty well last week. The idea that the public investment front of Saudi Arabia is stepping away, that doesn't mean LIV Golf is over. If you can find another investor, I think there would be interest in what they do internationally. They have found a foothold internationally, and maybe there will be a version of it. All those things are being said is before all this happened, let's say ever since Bryson DeChambeau beat Rory at Pinehurst for the U.S. Open, we started talking about the negotiations for this new contract. And that new contract included nine figures. That's nine figures. That was a lot of money he was going to be asking for. And I think you and I both agreed with the idea that LIV Golf is going to go as Bryson DeChambeau goes. And so he is at the max. He has the maximum amount of leverage right now when it comes to these negotiations. I can't imagine any universe where he's going to walk in the room and go, you know what? Forget about all that. I'm just going to stick around just for the good of the league, for the good of the game. He may truly believe that, but I don't think that's the way this is going to go down. I think the idea that he wants to try to stay loyal to the league as long as he can, knowing that something's going to have to change because he's probably not going to get that nine-figure payout now.
It is interesting. Over the past couple of weeks, we have seen sort of a rallying cry from the LIV players who have seen sort of their future be imperiled and are pushing back against the notion that this thing is about to just fold up his tent and every player is going to have to disperse to various tours. And look, Bryson DeChambeau is obviously financially motivated for this thing to keep going. He owns 25% of his Crushers team. The Crushers have been one of the most successful, sponsorable and promoted teams in the LIV Golf League. And so he's obviously financially motivated to see it succeed, especially, Rex, if we're in this new era and this new environment where the massive signing bonuses are going to be a thing of the past. And so if the franchise that, again, that he has equity in is sort of his gateway to a higher earning value, then yeah, obviously he's going to want to see the Crushers and LIV Golf stick around. So I guess I'm loving his actual belief in what he's doing. I'm laughing that it's actually going to happen. Again, I still don't see a long-term investor looking at LIV, which has torched more than $5 billion since its inception in 2022, and seeing a viable path forward without some serious changes to the model. And so, yes, that was a dual answer. I'm loving what Bryson is saying. I'm laughing that it's actually going to happen. How about that?
And you just explained how the game is played to the fine folks, and you didn't play it correctly.
It's my game.
You sat on the fence.
And I can make the rules.
You took your perch on the fence and decided, you know what? I'm loving part of this and laughing the other part of it. Well done. Well done by you.
If ever you come up with your own segment, you can play by whatever rules you want.
I gave you the name for this segment.
I know. You sure did. All right. Second topic. Jackson Koivun continued his winning ways, winning for the sixth time in eight starts in the spring for his Auburn Tigers, which did not win the team championship or the SEC championship, but he did win individually, which brought up an interesting question, Rex. Are you loving or laughing the idea that Jackson Koivun, who already has a PGA Tour card wrapped up, is he the best amateur since Tiger Woods?
I mean, honestly, I'm loving that to play the game the way you're it's supposed to be played. I'm loving that. Yeah. I want to defer here is what I want to do. You are the expert here. You are better at covering college golf than anyone else. Burkowski's right behind you. You two are 1A and 1B. So I don't know if I'm really the one to ask about this. I will say that was his third SEC title. And as you pointed out, that's his fifth win this season, I think, in eight starts. He has been absolutely dominant this year as a junior at Auburn. But that's not the part that impresses me. The part that impresses me is what he did last fall on the PGA Tour. Last fall, he had four consecutive starts in the top 11. As an amateur. And you're right. He already has his PGA Tour card. And I love this entire conversation as we're sitting here just after you and I probably overdosed on all of the draft, NFL draft talk and all the NFL draft coverage over the course of the week. I feel like your Jacksonville Jaguars got nothing done over the course of those seven rounds. However,
plotting.
Plotting is the way I would say it. I'm always cautious when it comes to these young players. And I guess not to be mean or throw anybody under the bus, but here I go. If you and I would have been having this conversation after the 2022 NCAA championship, you probably would have offered a similar question to me with Gordon Sargent. And I would say probably then I would have deferred to you and Burko as well. However, I had to go look it up. In his last 20 official world golf ranking starts, he has one top 10 and 30 miscuts or 13 miscuts. There is no guarantee for success. It's hard to make that jump. I'm not picking on Gordon Sargent. I'm just pointing out that making that transition to the next level is always difficult, even for a player as talented as Jackson.
Yeah, and look, we've seen that happen with Nick Dunlap as well, who won on the PGA Tour as an amateur. Although he won the Barracuda that same year, He's really struggled off the tee as well. What I think I've been most impressed about what Jackson Koivun has done, Rex, is that he already has the PGA Tour card locked up through the PGA Tour University Accelerator Program, which sort of awards points for major achievements, and he's had several in his college career. To this point, he's just a junior at Auburn, and yet he's only gotten better this year. You know, he could have been satiated. He could have relaxed. He could have enjoyed what is very likely to be his final year of college golf, and instead, he's just put the foot to the pedal and just absolutely steamrolled competition that in college golf is supposed to be better, stronger, faster, deeper than ever before. As it relates to this actual question, we have no way to really quantify it. Our friends at Data Golf do have been tracking this since 2010, and at least statistically through strokes gain data, or at least from the Data Golf rankings, Jackson Koivun is the best amateur since at least 2010. And think about all the great players that have come out of the college system or just the amateur golf rankings since 2010. We're talking Jon Rahm. We're talking Jordan Spieth. We're talking Patrick Rogers, who won 11 times at Stanford. We're talking about Luke Clanton, as you mentioned, who was a great college player and who arrived on the PGA Tour with a bunch of fanfare. We're talking about Colin Morikawa and Victor Hovland, all of those players are sort of in this range, which again, according to our friends at Data Golf, Jackson Koivun has been better than all of them. But as someone who sort of cut their teeth on the college and amateur ranks, it just feels a little bit different, where Jackson Koivun just feels a little bit more professional. It feels like he's a professional amateur at this point, depending on what sort of sources you're using. Jackson Koivun is making more than $2 million in NIL and other assorted deals. He's played plenty of PGA Tour events. I still think John Rahm and Jordan Spieth, for my money, are the best amateurs to come out since Tiger Woods. You look at not just their college accomplishments, but certainly in the case of Jordan Spieth, the amateur accomplishments as well, winning the U.S. Junior twice as well, the only player to do that since Tiger Woods. It just feels different. It feels like a different time. That's no knock on Jackson Koivun. He's clearly going to be an awesome PGA Tour player. I can't wait until he very likely turns pro after the NCAA championship. But to say he's the best amateur since Tiger, I don't know. It's just anecdotal, but I'm not sure I necessarily agree with that. All right, let's look at this week's Cadillac Championship with Doral Rex missing five of the top 15 players in the world ranking. That's Rory McIlroy, who is not going to be teeing it up this week. We'll see him next week at Quail Hollow for the Truist Championship. We do not have Matt Fitzpatrick, who just won with his brother at the Zurich. We don't have Xander Schauffele, Ludvig Åberg, or Bobby McIntyre as well. Are you loving or laving the idea that a PGA Tour signature event is missing five of the top 15?
I'm laving it. More importantly, I think Brian Rolapp, the CEO of the PGA Tour, is probably laving it. And like we've talked about this before, this is load management come to the PGA Tour, and it's only going to get worse. If we go towards this future that Rolapp and the rest of the tour wants, where we only have major championships, players' championships, and signature events, you're going to have windows where players aren't going to play consecutive weeks in a row. Now, it is interesting, as you pointed out, Matt Fitzpatrick won with his brother this week in New Orleans, won last week in Hilton Head, played well the week before that at the Masters. So him taking the week off should be no surprise whatsoever. Sure. The fact that he was willing to play three in a row is a little bit shocking there. It's no big surprise to see Rory take off back-to-back weeks. He clearly does not like Hilton Head as a stop. It doesn't feel like it's a golf course that suits him. I'm a little surprised he didn't show up at Doral simply because it's close to home. It seems like that's the kind of golf course he would like. But also, you're looking ahead. After Doral, you have the Truist Championship at Quail Hollow, which is a signature event, followed by the PGA Championship. It doesn't let up, and it's only going to get worse if this new reality comes into play. If Brian Rolapp gets his way in the PGA Tour schedule, goes to that Tier 1 and Tier 2 structure, this is going to be a real problem. I mean, we see it all the time in other sports, the NBA being the primary issue here. And Adam Silver, the commissioner of the NBA, still hasn't figured out an answer. I think Brian Rolapp's going to have to start thinking long and hard about how he can make this version work.
Yeah, when we listened to Brian Rolapp at the Players' Championship, we'd done the math, and it was like 25 or 26 events in a 32-week span. And that's building in a couple of off weeks. And so I think a couple of things here are true, is that every player is different, but by and large, they don't want to play three events in a row with that final event culminating with a major championship. Doral, tough test. Quail Hollow, tough test. Players do not want to be completely beat up at Aronimink for the PGA Championship. Rory's not playing this week. He's expected to play next week at Quail Hollow. Scotty Scheffler's playing this week in Miami, not expected to play the following week at Quail Hollow. Every single player is going to be different. But if you're Brian Rolapp, you have to be looking at the schedule crunch that we have right now. With between major championships, we have three signature events in a four-week span. Again, if the PGA Tour looks completely different and you do have these Tier 1 tournaments and there's 15 or 16 of them and they're spaced out correctly during the course of a PGA Tour season with off weeks built in, then yeah, I don't think you'll have this mass exodus or these players who are deciding to skip. You might have the offshoot. And I think Rory McIlroy, who sort of helped engineer this signature event model back in 2022, I think he's earned the right at this point to pick and choose his schedule. He's no longer flying the flag for the PGA Tour. He doesn't feel like he's beholden to them in any way. And as a generationally great player, as a living legend, I don't think he has a responsibility to play in these events as well. It's up to the PGA Tour schedule makers to make it conducive and make it really appealing to the top players to want to play. I think it could be an entirely different conversation, Rex, if you had a week off heading into the PGA Championship, or you had a week off on the back end of a major championship. I understand sort of the thinking of you want to build momentum heading into a major. You want to have sort of that player who wins the final event, can carry it in the following week. But it might be better off for PGA Tour schedule makers just to build in an off week so you don't have this situation where players are looking ahead in the schedule and wanting to miss these $20 million signature events because they want to make sure they're fresh for a major.
And I think you and I did this experiment where whenever it is this 2-1 schedule is going to start, it's going to start somewhere around, well, we're going to have this conversation in just a minute, the American Express or the Phoenix Open, somewhere in that area, right? Probably right around the Super Bowl weekend would be my guess. And if you look at most calendars, they fluctuate from year to year. But if you extrapolated that out and you could build in 4 off weeks, essentially, based on what they want to do, the major championships and the players championship. So then the question went to, if you're going to have 4 off weeks, maybe 5 off weeks, is it going to be the week before or week after a major championship? And it seemed like the consensus when I did this story last year in the Bahamas was the week after was where most guys wanted it to land. But that's not the case anymore. Now you're starting to hear a lot of players talk about that. No, I don't want to play the week before. Every player is different. We've seen it in Rory. Rory doesn't even prepare for every major the same way. Sometimes he likes to play the week before. Sometimes he likes to take a couple weeks off like he did for the Masters going into it. It's just a feel thing for him. Whereas Tiger Woods was a little bit different and the schedule was set up different when he was in his prime, where Firestone was a perfect setup for him to go to the PGA Championship. Memorial was a perfect setup for him to get ready for the U.S. Open. That's not going to be the case. So I'm with you. The schedule makers are going to have to be cognizant of this. They're going to have to be creative. But if you've only got 4 or 5 off weeks in that window, I don't even know if that's going to be enough because you're still going to end up having to play consecutive weeks.
Unless you really pare down the tier one schedule to where Maybe. You do have those built-in breaks. But at that point, then are you really providing enough playing opportunities for players to have an actual shot at keeping their tour card for 2028 or beyond, whatever the schedule? I think that's going to get a little bit messy as well.
No, and I don't think the financial model works then. Like, that's the conversation now. Can I pare down PGA Tour schedule, financially stack up to what they need it to be and sustain these $20 million purses? That's another stumbling point that they seem to have stumbled across, I guess, to put it another way. The Future Competitions Committee. There is something to be said for a 38-event schedule. That there is something, there is quantity there that you can sell to the media partners, to different corporate sponsors, to presenting sponsors. If you pare that down by even just percentage points, that means just that's percentage points you're not going to get back in revenue.
We forgot the rules of the game. You and I are both laving that question, though. As well as Durrell missing 5 of its top 15.
No, I think I said lav. You're the one that didn't do it for the last 2.
Yeah, it happens. But it was a good segue, Rex, to this final question for the Love It or Lav It segment. We'll try to get the rules of the game right next time. The American Express, right now, that's the only tournament on the 2027 PGA Tour schedule that has a date, January 21st through 24th, 2027. Do you think that tournament should be the kickoff point for the PGA Tour season? This, of course, in the wake of the news that the Hawaii swing is all but dead.
Yeah, I love it. And for a lot of different reasons, there's a lot of history there. When you talk to people in Brian Rolapp's universe, they talk about going to major markets and getting the top players together more often. These are all the catchphrases. These are the things they want to lean into. But there's also something to be said for these iconic venues. You talk about Hilton Head all the time. You talk about some of these places that you're going to Memorial. Dublin is not a major market, but you're going to go there because it's Jack's tournament, because it's so important to the PGA Tour and the structure and the DNA. The American Express is different because I wouldn't call any of the 3 venues that they play for the American Express iconic on any level, but I think the event itself is iconic because this goes back to the Bob Hope
historic,
days.
Traditional.
It harkens back to what the tour was when it first became financially viable, when Arnold Palmer was the one that was sort of dragging it into this financial viability stage. Now, whether or not if that means anything to the people who are sitting in power now in Ponte Vedra Beach and Brian Rolapp, I don't know that, because as we had this conversation about the Century and the Sony Open going away last week and reporting by Doug Ferguson from the AP, that made sense to me, because even though you and I both, like, Mark Roffing has done amazing work in Maui and he's going to continue to fight to get a tour event or a PGA Tour Champions event in Maui, it just made financial sense. If you're going to start clipping off PGA Tour events, those were the 2 easiest ones. That was the low-hanging fruit, to be quite frank, because it was expensive to send the traveling circus all the way over there that time of year. The ratings normally weren't very good. Players didn't particularly love starting the season out. And, like, you can go back decades now. Like, Tiger and Phil didn't like to play Kapalua because they didn't like starting their seasons battling the winds in Kapalua. And once you got to the Sony Open, that was a different kind of golf course. It didn't suit some players. That all made sense. So if you're looking at yourself in the mirror now, if you're the American Express or really any tournament that's maybe on the outside looking in, you're trying to find a way to convince the PGA Tour that this is why I deserve to be part of Tier 1. And I think the American Express can make that argument.
I'm laughing it because if the PGA Tour wants to start with a bang, I would suggest Phoenix first and foremost.
Sure.
Doral would be a great option as well. Go to where the players are. They live in South Florida. That's an easy kickoff event for the PGA Tour season. All right, after this very short break, we're going to have an even shorter version of Voices in the Crowd. Stay with us. All right, Rex was just gasbagging that last section, so now this is going to be a Rex-only edition of the Voices in the Crowd. Rex, this one from Ann Wasson. Any chance the PGA can be moved back to August?
Absolutely. I would say the PGA was at its best when it was in August. It was Glory's last shot, and I think it's still looking for that identity. That'd be a great way to get it.
Needs to have an identity, but that would involve a whole schedule remake and better coordination among
we're
all
doing
golf's
it anyway.
Major parties. How about this one from Bravo? They should put the playoffs on the West Coast. We're talking Torrey Pebble, Olympic, Bandon, Chambers. You like that?
I love the idea. I'm laughing the idea that you could sell that. Look, there's a reason why those venues are out
prime
there.
Prime time, baby.
Prime time works, but we can start at FedEx. I know Memphis isn't the place you want to be in July or August, but there's a reason why we're in Memphis.
Yeah, we're not going to have Pebble. Bandon, although you and I both love Bandon. Nah, I'm not sure that one works Bandon as a PGA Tour playoff venue as well. Chambers Bay would love to see that back in the spotlight. Absolutely, Torrey and Olympic could definitely be options. How about this one from Slim Pickens, who said if Rom came back to the PGA Tour, they should hold him hostage and want 50% of his money back. You buying that?
I am not buying it. He doesn't want to go back. John Rahm doesn't want to go back to the European Tour, and he's virtually getting just the lightest of slaps on the wrist. I mean, it is nothing compared to what the PGA Tour did to Brooks Koepka. So I don't even see John playing ball at this point.
Yeah, if he doesn't want to have a $3 million fine to pay off his debts to the DP World Tour, what's the any sort of belief that he's going to do $5 million plus to get back on the PGA Tour?
And sit around as the first alternate in Hilton Head. Do you think he's going to do that?
No, thank you. Brooks Koepka, of course, the first alternate this week at Doral as well. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of the Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lav. We'll be back on Wednesday for a full preview of the PGA Tour signature event at Doral and any other news and notes that comes up. Thanks for listening. Thanks for support. Talk to you guys in a couple of days.